And I'm having a little bit of a problem with this one. First of all, the cloudburst noise, the lightning strike or whatever, is extremely broadband. It doesn't favor any particular frequency. When you put a Q multiplier on a cloudburst of noise, with no limiter of any kind, no noise blanker, no noise limiter, it's like striking a bell with your Q multiplier emphasizing some particular frequency. A cloudburst will come along, and now you'll hear the ringing of that cloudburst in that filter. I've heard that effect. I'll admit that if you're using a real good noise blanker, all kinds of good things can happen. And there are noise blankers and there are noise blankers. So noise blanker that's in the Dracoff 4C or in the Kenwood 520 or 840 are known to be very good noise blankers. And as such, they manage to remove the energy of a cloudburst, a lightning strike, before it gets a chance to ring the high-Q filter. That's a great advantage of a good noise blanker. If you try to do noise blanking after it's been through a very narrowband filter, and the filter is like a bell that's been set ringing, you don't get anywhere near as much benefit anymore. Now, once the filter is set very narrow to listen to that particular tone of a Morse code signal, to an untrained ear, it sounds like you have a huge advantage. You've now got a great signal-to-noise ratio. But what has been discovered with laboratory experiments, let me drop, is that when you have a well-trained CW operator, he is able to, with the equivalent of digital signal processing that exists within his head, between his ears, he can narrow up his tuning to 50 hertz of bandwidth. And within that 50 hertz, he can decide to listen to that particular tone and mentally ignore all others as long as they're not real whoppers in amplitude. And so, the bottom line is that when you're listening to a weak tone in the noise, whether you listen to it with a broadband filter or a narrowband filter, to a trained set of ears, the weak signal threshold is the exact same signal level, plus or minus a small fraction of a dB, to a trained operator. To a neophyte, when I was a novice, oh boy, all those tones confused the daylights out of me. I hadn't yet developed the skill of narrowing up my thinking to one particular tone. But once you develop that ability, it may be more convenient to use a narrow filter, but you don't pick up an advantage. That's what the laboratory experiments are saying. You're saying something slightly different. You're saying an opinion that's held by a lot of people, but they haven't been able to confirm it in a laboratory yet, Glenn. How about you, Glenn? KQRIW.
Dick, I completely agree with you on what you're saying with the CW signal. Where it becomes, I think, a little bit different that the filter, the Q multiplier, isn't that narrow. That's the first thing. And we're also talking about sideband signals now here, too. If you try to, with real audio, I'm not talking about CW here, where, like you're saying, you can only pick out that tone, that narrow, like, 500 hertz tone, low above the noise. Absolutely, that's unequivocal. You don't need a Q multiplier for that. I'm talking about sideband signals. Or if you have a lot of hashy noise in the background that's hashing through, and it's not the exact burst itself, because those just come through like ticks when you're listening on sideband, it's like a, and then it's gone. What I'm talking about is sometimes there's like a white noise floor that literally your whole S level in your receiver just comes up to the point of where normally you could listen to somebody in an S4, and all of a sudden next thing you know, you've got an S6 noise floor that just rose up. Using the Q multiplier, you're not that narrow that where you're coming in, you know, to within 500 hertz. You're still at maybe 2 to 3 kilohertz with the tuning of that high Q filter that you have there. And what's happening is you're creating somewhat of that quasi-resonance. And by moving the loop antenna or some local antenna around, you can get just enough signal riding on it. You follow a little bit more about what I'm saying now, but if you like this.
Yes, I do, and I
got to
guess. If I'm listening to a relatively weak guy at 3,700 sideband, 3,750, and if somebody does a tune-up 15 kilohertz away, and my audio passband on my receiver goes only to 12 kilohertz, where it really drops off like a brick. So 15 kilohertz away, The guy is tuning up the transmitter, key down, real strong. All of a sudden, where I'm listening, I hear noise rise. His noise side bands of his synthesizer, whatever. He's overloading the front end of my receiver, but I don't hear him. I don't know he's there. All I know is yes meter rose with what looks like broadband noise that suddenly came in. And as long as the stages of the receiver up to the point of the Q multiplier did not saturate with that strong signal, and now I turned on the Q multiplier, which has got some pretty strong filter skirts to it, and it's now eliminating that guy tuning up 15 KC away, and he's no longer getting into the rest of the receiver system, I'm going to get an improvement. Is it possible that was giving you the noise rise? Because in order for a Q multiplier to eliminate truly broadband noise that's across the whole band of interest, not just created by an overload by somebody nearby, but if I really have noise on the band, and I'm not changing the pattern of the antenna, I'm just using a Q multiplier, I don't think the Q multiplier with truly broadband noise has the smarts to know the difference between sideband signal and noise to differentiate one from the other. I wish a Q multiplier can do that. I don't think it can. Now back to you, Glenn, Q2LIW.
Here again, Rick. Dick, I completely agree. I don't believe that it's the Q multiplier that has the intelligence. I think it's the receiver that actually has the intelligence. What's really happening, as I said, like just as you nailed it, what's happening is that 75-meter band is really, really narrow, and you've got guys all over the place, and some nights you'll turn on, and the noise floor is just horrendously high, and some of it is QRM, some of it is QRN. It's all over the place down there. And, you know, you might have a frequency that you have a net on normally, and there might be guys transmitting on the same frequency in another part of the country, another part of the world, that you really don't hear, but they're just elevating the noise floor a little bit on the other end. And if you have a Q multiplier, and you can kind of narrow things out, and then let your receiver, which is really doing the work, after that, and then sometimes, especially with the newer solid-state radio, you basically use the Q multiplier, then put like a pad in between that and the receiver, just to bring the overall level down to somewhere normalized so that the receiver will receive a little bit better. You can pick out signals that are without a lot of noise that normally were there, where if you're trying to use your big loop antenna on the outside, it just the strongest signals that would come in first, the noise floor and everything is elevated, and the chances of hearing those smaller signals are just it's going to be much harder to do, where you could have an antenna indoors on 75-80 meters with a loop on it like Mel has, a nice Q multiplier, a pad between that and the receiver, and it's basically just getting rid of a lot of the hash on the outside of those sideband signals, where you're just getting enough additional filtering out of the antenna to get the other stuff out of the way, and it's really easing the life of the receiver is really what's happening.
Okay. When you're using the Q multiplier for sideband reception, when you're getting a noise rise in the receiver that tends to cover up the weak signal from sideband, what do you believe is the mechanism by which the Q multiplier is improving the signal-to-noise ratio? Back to you, Glenn.
Well, I think what happens is that if you have a loop antenna that's relatively tuned close to the frequency that you're listening to, that a lot of the other noise isn't really on that frequency. It's just close by, and it's a nuisance, and it's raising your noise floor. So what really the Q multiplier is doing is it's kind of narrowing out all the garbage on either side. You're focusing on one frequency, and then by having that ability of moving the antenna in a polarization that's not polarized very well with the noise, but polarized in a much better direction to set more of the signal that you're interested in. That's what I think is really happening there.
Mel, you've used Q multipliers, you've used loop antennas in the shack. Have you seen an interplay between the tuning of the loop antenna as L and polarization compatible with the Q multiplier such that the combination gave you a better signal-to-noise ratio of a weak sideband signal that nears some noise? Have you seen an improvement there that you wouldn't have gotten without the Q multiplier? Have you seen the effect that I think, Jeff? Glenn is describing here. T2KEY, T2LIW.
This is T2KEY. Well, that's basically what you're describing. I am using that loop, and I have a second loop. Remember, it's a loop inside of a loop. They both are on the same frame, but they can move in independent of one another. One loop I use to pick up, I think, the noise on it. That's how I set it. I set it to basically, let's say I'm getting a noise, specific repetitious noise in one direction. I peak it with the first of one loop. The other loop, I peak the signal. I then go into the noise squasher that I built, the QRN squasher, and then to bring the signal back up to a combined level to produce this into the input of the receiver, I use actually a type of Q multiplier circuit. This is basically the layout that I'm using. I'll call it a distance Q multiplier, more like an RF amplification circuit, but because of its configuration, I guess you can call it maybe somewhat of a cousin to a Q multiplier. But with that QRN squashing system is, I think, part of the success of that receiving loop, because if I were to listen to a noise level of 75 many times, let's say F7, F8, F9, I mean, that's not unusual. If I put it through this system that I'm using, I will get that signal. The receive signal will be, let's say it's an F9 signal, and the noise level is almost equal. You know, you couldn't make much intelligence. But I can bring the noise level if I listen to that same frequency, and if nobody's talking, the noise level, I can reduce it down, let's say, from F8, 9 to F3 easily, pick over.
Wow. Okay. If I allowed you to use all of the tuning controls on the antenna, I see the problem here, and your noise squasher, but the antenna is part of your Q multiplier, it's an RF Q multiplier you're using. I was about to try to ask you how many additional decibels of improvement are you getting out of the Q multiplier? And that's not easy to quantify because it's wrapped into the antenna, if I understand correctly. It's an RF Q multiplier you're using. But it sounds like you're getting a significant number of decibels of overall receiver-to-noise ratio improvement by that scheme. Now, explaining it, say, for instance, you put this in technical topics in QFT, explaining what it's doing and teaching a person how to tweak all these controls to do it correctly strikes me as no easy task. I think if you wrote that particular technical topic, Mel, I think you'd get an awful lot of mail, and some of that mail would be a little bit frustrating. What do you think? T2LAW.
Almost definitely, because I've demonstrated this to people that are, I would say, fairly, you know, knowledgeable. They're not newcomers, they're knowledgeable to be able to grasp, you know, what exactly is taking place. And they couldn't follow what I was doing. I set it up for them, and I actually put their hand and say, yeah, turn this a little bit. And they turn, now what am I supposed to be doing? It's like, okay, peak this, move this, you know. That's the problem. Therein lies the problem. I'm on 3820. I'm listening and talking to my friend in Pennsylvania. All of a sudden, they, you know, stand by and somebody comes in. One of the guys come in, say, from down south in Carolina. We usually get a big group together. Many nights we have 10 people. I'm busier than a one-armed bandit if I'm going to try to bring in one of those other signals. In other words, what I have to do in many cases, if it's a weak signal, I say, wait a minute, give me a minute to swing, turn, and just do some idle chatter so I can pick you up and pick you out there. But a lot of times I just go over to my regular outside loop because, like I say, by the time otherwise I would get everything set, the QSO would be over. It's a lot to maneuver. I've got two variable adjustments on the loop antennas, you know, plus turning them and twisting and tilting them. Then I've got on the QRN squasher. I got three more controls, plus maneuvering and fooling around with the receiver, the rejection tuning, and all the other little odds and ends on the column phase 4 receiver. See, I have to use, let me let it drop. Because of the situation that most of the time on 75 meters, in order to be heard, you've got to run a kilowatt plus. And I don't think you can take a chance with this type of receiving setup and put it into a modern, receiver with a kilowatt amplifier sitting, blasting away there, no matter, you know, how little, maybe RF may be floating around the shack. I think you may do something to the receiver, so you'd have to have some elaborate way of also of disconnecting that antenna system during transmitting so that the loop antenna that's highly resonant at that frequency doesn't pump maybe a sufficient amount into your receiver. So I use the A4 because it's a tube receiver and it's, more forgiving. So that's the setup basically. Go ahead.
My impression is that your loop antenna is not that expensive. So if you wanted to transmit with a loop antenna, I think you could use a second one. You have to be a little bit careful in the way you place it so that the coupling between the two is not huge. And up till now, I know you've been reluctant to transmit from the same shack with you being in there with it. I understand that. So maybe you want to put the loop antenna up on the roof of the house and have a Azel pole motor, steer it. But I think with a separate antenna, you could be transmitting with a loop also. Have you even transmitted QRP with the loop, Mel? Go ahead.
I did one experiment with a local, and I wanted to see. I went down to about 25 watts, and I put it into this thing, and I compared it. And I said, just listen, I'm going to put it into the full-wave loop, and then I'm going to put it into the another antenna. And did an AB. I didn't want them to really know what initially what I'm doing. And he said for the life of him at the time, wasn't located too far away, because, 75 meters to really do anything at night, you've got to have, everybody, we call it kilowatt alley, everybody's running power. Anyone comes on with a 100-watt rig in most cases barely hurts, unless I keep them up with my receiving boost and my little fiddling around there. But I tried it, and Tommy Bean says just as equally well, and no problem, saying that one antenna predominated over the other. I would say that no doubt you could maybe come up with some idea of remote controlling the whole contraption. It would be a bit of a problem because you're going to have to add listen elevation, and you got to have to be aware if you're going to have to rotate that variable capacitor and all, and weatherproof and everything. It would be a bit of a project, but I guess if somebody was really interested in doing it, I'm sure they could figure out how to get around all these different problems. Over.
Yep, I hear you. Now, if Alex is there, I've got a question for Alex. Alex, are you still on frequency? N2NNU, K2RIW?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. What's your question, Dick? Go ahead.
You've seen a Saturn 6 halo antenna, a 6-meter antenna that people use as a mobile antenna. Would you call that a magnetic sensing antenna? Go ahead.
What did you reach the conclusion I've seen that? No, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm sorry. I'm not a radio amateur. I'm a radio constructor. Sorry for that.
It's a halo.
Okay. A halo antenna. A meld loop antenna is 270-foot circumference wire loop antenna, 70 feet in the air. In your mind, is that an E-field antenna, an H-field antenna, or an electromagnetic sensing antenna? Which do you think that one is, Alex? Go ahead.
Okay, well, that's a tough one. Now, the lowest part of the antenna, how high is it over the ground?
45 feet, which I guess you would think it as a little shy of 15 meters above the ground, and 80 meters in circumference.
This is a wild guess, but because it's much less than a quarter wavelength, I think it is a magnetic antenna. However, not sure what the construction is of. The wire should be very, very thick in order to, should be comparable to something like a tenth or at least a 32 of the wavelength in order to become a truly magnetic antenna. But because it's so close to the ground, he will receive the magnetic part of the wave that is, as you well know, inclined. As it propagates from the source to him, he will receive the delayed part of it, the one that's close to the Earth. My guess it is that it is a magnetic antenna.
Okay, and the 10-foot diameter, the 3-meter diameter loop antenna that he puts in the shack with him, I think you're saying that is a purely H-field receiving antenna, even though he's resonating it. Is that true? Go ahead.
Well, the little antenna is just an inductor. It's a tuned inductor. You cannot call it an antenna anymore. It has a very, very high Q, very, very narrow bandwidth, and this is why he gets that much less noise on it, and that's why he gets much more signal on it. On resonance, its impedance disappears. It becomes a very high impedance, and the entire signal is applied to the radio.
Mel, when you tune your loop antenna that's in the shack with you, what's your approximate guess as to its 2-to-1 Vizwa bandwidth or 3 dB bandwidth, whichever? Is that antenna 3 kilohertz wide, 15 kilohertz wide, 150 kilohertz? How far can you tune the receiver before you got to re-resonate the antenna? Back to you, Mel.
This K2KY, very small. I would say, I'll give you a quick guess. I would say maybe 2 kilohertz either side. Nothing very much. I mean, it is extremely critical. I have tried, used on it. I have gear reduction system on the variable. I have a nice, I found variables that were really smooth operating variables. I'm basically using from broadcast radio about, 365 PF variable capacitor. And these are ones with had nice smooth gear reduction. And even then, this is what, first time I used it, what amazed me, because when I first used it, actually, what I did is I put my ADA graphic antenna analyzer on it and opened up, to be able to look a couple hundred kilohertz either side of where I was, in other words, look at the whole ADA band to see if I had any spot where I could resonate the thing. And then all of a sudden, I see this deep skirt on the graphic display. And I'm saying, what in the heck is that? And I'm moving the variable, and I'm moving the skirt actually across the screen. And I'm saying, look at the sharpness of this thing. This thing looks like, a rejection tuning system that you would say, boy, look at that skirt on the in fact, that's exactly what I was looking at, the same type of response you would look at if you had a very sharp filter thing over.
Wow. That's what Alex has been saying. So let me try this experiment on you. At high noon, any day of the year, on 80 meters, the D layer absorption is extremely high. With rare exception, you're not going to hear any other signal on the band. And if I was tuning the antenna to 3820 kilohertz, and I tune the receiver to 3820 kilohertz, I'm going to hear the broadband D-layer noise. If I then took the tuning dial of the receiver and tuned up 5 kc and tuned down 5 kc, I think you're telling me the S-meter would come down to a much lower amount of noise because of the Q of the antenna. Is that approximately true? Back to you, Mel.
Yes, that's what I have on there. I have a scope on the receiver also. I have the spectrum display scope on there, and that I homebrewed also onto the system. because basically how I adjust it, I watch the noise floor. In other words, I'm without the, and there's two receiving loops. Remember, there's one inside the other. So I take into one that my noise sensing, and I'm watching the noise floor on the scope until I see the minimal ripple. And then I'm looking at the other one, and I'm maximizing the signal as a peak signal. But if you were just to start the tune, you'd see the noise floor come up. At the same time, you would see the signal as you move away. Of course, I can look approximately the way I have the scope set right now. I look about 25 kilohertz either side of my signal, just to see what's doing, keeping an eye on what's doing on the band. If it's, you know, a strong signal comes on, and sometimes I'll tune just to see who it is, because I know most of the guys are 75. So I'm looking about 25 kilohertz either side of this frequency that I'm listening on. And if I start tuning, in other words, moving the dial towards that other signal, you see the one on 3820 that I was looking at, you see that starting to go down, the signal on amplitude. You see your noise floor starting to come up, and then you see that other signal that you're going towards starting to even out, and then, when of course, when you readjust the variable, that one pops up, you're doing the reverse again. But you actually can see it move as you're moving across the band, the effect right on the scope gets over.
I think you're saying you normally set your pan adapter to look 25 kc up, 25 kc down. You set it for about 50 kilohertz of bandwidth, but the antenna shows you a peak of noise in the middle of that pan adapter that's only a few percent of the width of the screen on the pan adapter. Is that approximately true?
Actually, what I'm doing is so that the pan adapter, so I can just see if any other, you know, the other signals that are coming on the band and all, so because it's funny, I guess I know at a certain frequency who's going to come on, like down. You see, approximately every 5 kilohertz at night on 75 meters, there's another group. It's all nests. You want to call them nests. I mean, it's just get-togethers, and we all know each other, basically. You get to know everybody that I'm on 3820, because we have upwards about, off and on, about 20 people that join us. And I know of some of the other groups around, so sometimes I'll just scoot over and say, listen, I want to say hello to so-and-so. I know he's operating, getting together with a group down five, so I can see them coming on, you know, whereas I see it on the screen. But you can see that the noise floor of the place where I am is the minimum, whereas around me, you can see as you're going off towards either side, you can see that the noise floor is picking up, take over.
You guys normally get together on 3820 on, did you say something like 8 o'clock on Thursday night? Go ahead.
Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I'm with the group that's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. That's around 11:30 at night, 11:30 to midnight to about 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. Depends on who's there. But it's a real fascinating group that gets on there. We have usually get together around that time at night and get a bunch of check-ins. It's ideal up to about 1 o'clock in the morning. Then the group, like I say, sometimes we combine the two groups together that are simultaneously operating. The other group is on the West Coast, takes over.
Wow. What an enthusiastic group. Out of curiosity, what's the typical subject you guys discuss? Antennas, of course. Go ahead.
Not necessary antennas. There's three or four guys on the group that were very involved, and one or two are still involved, with the racing field of automobiles. One guy, in fact, he retired. He was the guy who made the original high-speed transmission for the race cars. His son now is with this group, what the heck they call them, they got this group that's very, very well known in race cars, built race cars. This other guy, Terry, is in Philadelphia. He builds race cars, but different types. He builds these stock races. The other one builds a Formula One, and this kind of winds up a lot of the conversation. What else is there? Another guy from Virginia Beach. He he was in Hollywood with special effects involving electronics and all. He knew all the movie stars. And so he's quite fascinating to see. Then there's Tony, who, believe it or not, was an engineer, taught at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, but wound up as a musician. He's quite an accomplished musician. Wound up teaching music there and gave up the engineering field, so he comes on. And I can go on and on. This is to give you a cross section of what goes on, take over.
What a group. Okay. I'll pass it over to Alex if he wants to say anything more, and after that, maybe you should go to the next mailbag. Alex, anything you want to add to all of this? KQRIW. KQRIW,
give us
one
more comment.
Okay. Well, not much. Just that I would not recommend mail to transmit with this antenna. It'll make quite a spark. A spark transmitter there with a capacitor if he doesn't have enough spacing between his plate. But basically, that's what it is. It's a coil, a very high Q coil. And, nothing else. Back to you, Dick.
What net is this that Nell is talking about? I don't know if the net has a name. Here we go. Nell, does your net have a name?
Cam radio, CAM, the cam radio, cam, because a number of the guys get on and they're on the internet simultaneously showing each other a picture of what they're doing, projects and all. This is my next to join them in my on cam radio suit. They bring through a BIOS line here that they call themselves the cam, CAM radio, over.
And cam represents the a kind of a cam that works with the valves of an automobile engine. Is that what's going on?
Oh, cam means camera. They're on the internet. It means camera radio. It's in other words, they're on the internet using showing. In fact, if you go to cam radio, if you Google camradio.net, you'll see exactly their pictures. If you go on 11:30 at night, take a look at it. You'll see pictures of a bunch of guys. All the guys from 3820. Dick, over.
Interesting, Glenn. You got it.
Yeah, Dick, I definitely advise taking a look at that website. It's pretty interesting. As a matter of fact, if you have BIOS connection and you like going on that frequency, you can actually see who you're talking to in real time. A lot of fun. Just another quick comment and observation about, using high Q multiplier loop antennas. I've experimented with them with just receivers, never for transceive applications. I'm just strictly playing with like more portable receivers and things and seeing what kind of magic you can do with them. And what's interesting with that is that up to about 10 megahertz, like indoors, you can get phenomenal results with a very, very small shortwave receiver and basically squash a lot of noise with a Q multiplier and a small little loop antenna just by moving it around. And it's impressive what you can actually pull out, what kind of signal. I remember even as a kid building it and, using a small, tune capacitor and basically just a wound loop on a small frame and doing that very, very interesting. There again, I've also tried it for frequencies higher than 10 megahertz. You can get it to work, but you have to get it some elevation and get it out of the house and above the ground. That goes with K2RIW, K2QIQ.
Yeah, I own a small portable transistorized radio receiver for WWV to get time signal. And it's also a weather radio. Except I think it listens on 2.5, 5, 10, and 15 megahertz. And it's got a whip antenna that comes out of the top that's expandable. And there are certain days where I can't find a position in the house or a frequency band where I get reasonably good reception in order to get that timing signal. If I built one of Mel's loop antennas, I bet you I can make a significant improvement on that. I wonder if you've ever considered that, ML. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I could say I've experimented just basically on 8 meters, 75 meters with it, and never really, really investigated other applications. But there's no doubt that once you try something like this, you're going to have something that's going to fascinate you. I mean, there's no other way to describe this. except that it is a fascinating situation that you show, you see that shows up. Now, they did sell transmitting antennas, you know, loop antennas, transmitting receiving antennas. AEA, you know, had that ISO loop. I think MFJ still may be still marketing one. And the basically, you know, as AEA really explained it, was they never really could sell them. They were too expensive. There was a number of reasons that just never took off. And they said the cost of them, because of the manufacturing difficulty that they were involved with, and that was that the variable capacitor that they came up with, that they were using in it, was a vacuum variable, which is a very costly situation. And they also did a, they didn't solder connections with, they welded things. I mean, it was a really a piece of construction. It was a well-made thing, piece of equipment, and that's why I guess it had the price tag on it. As far as situation, that's what I mean, you know, transmitting with it and all, I could see that it would be, you know, some problems involved in an antenna like that, you know, what they had to go through to be able to control it. So, you know, I had a remote, in other words, was made to be put outside. However, I did build a transmitting loop for a friend of mine for 20 meters. I described that. I made it out of copper pipe and soldered it together with copper. We soldered it together with silver solder, and it became a very effective antenna. I think I once described that. Let me let it drop, and I'll make a couple more comments about it. The antenna was made out of all copper pipe that we purchased at Home Depot using the elbows. Instead of, no, there was no way we could figure how we're going to bend this thing into the circumference we needed this copper pipe. So what we did is decide to use the off-the-shelf fitting, 45-degree fitting, 90-degree fitting, etc., and came up with a an antenna. And to get around this business with the capacitor, actually what we had is two pipes, two pieces of copper pipe side by side connected together, actually being pulled further and closer together with a plastic reed screw that you controlled with a long rod that actually was from a Venetian blind, one of those rods, those plastic rods that opens and closes the Venetian blind. I mean, that was actually the tuning tension on it. So, I mean, but it he took it to the city, took it to the reassembled it to the city, and worked quite well. That they put out our patio, painted it black, in fact. Oh, a whole business, quite a story on it. And worked out quite well on 20 CW with a dick over.
I may add something. Go ahead, Alex. Mel, try something. In front of the antenna, about, let's see, about 6 to 12 feet away, put a vertical stop grounded. That will modify your lob, your very first radiation lob from a circle to a very narrow band, very narrow oval, and that might give you some more gain. To tune the antenna, besides the capacitors, you can use two antennas, one next to another. The first antenna in front of it is shorted, or in the back, sorry, in the it's shorted. It is like now you are having some sort of crazy loop antenna of sorts, okay? And you can tune the antenna by varying the distance between the two loops, and that will get away from the need of a capacitor. Those two ideas to you, Mel. Back to Dick.
Okay, that's one approach. And another approach is you could have made an extremely high voltage tolerant variable capacitor by taking two pieces of copper pipe that are different in diameter, telescope them inside of each other with a piece of PVC pipe in between as the insulator. That could make for you a very high capacitance, very accurate tuning capacitance, yes, you'd have to make a sliding contacting finger stock or something like that in one spot if you didn't do it with a piece of wire. I wonder if you consider that, Mel. Go ahead.
Now, if you want, this is K2KEY, if you want to see some ideas on making high, so-called homebrew high voltage capacitors and all, and different ideas, take a look at the handbook. It's all an amateur radio handbook. Take a look at the loop. It's in there. I didn't invent this loop. I remember I told you I saw it in the book. You took a look at it. You saw the guy who came up with it, his XYL, standing there next to it, holding, you know, adjusting it. You saw the picture in the book there, Dick. And if you look a couple of pages before, they show you how to make the transmitting version of it and how to make the different methods of making high voltage capacitors. You take a look at that. There's some real innovative ideas. This is not my... I'm not going to take any credit for any of this design or anything. This is all in the amateur radio. I was just thumbing through the amateur radio handbook, and they have to have a certain portion of it. One, a couple of pages you saw right at the end where this guy had a problem of... particular QRM problem from a local broadcast station on 160. He built the one for 160 and solved his problem with this receiving loop for operating 160. I said, let me take this. Why can't I make this for 80 meters? Do the same thing and use it on 80 meters. That's all. Look in the handbook. It's all there. How he did the 160. Stages, like I say before you, the all the
main. Your push to talk button was quite intermittent on that last transmission, but we got most of what you're saying there, Mel. Okay, want to go to the next? Want to go to one more letter out of your mailbag?
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I got to hang on to this button real tight. Keep the button. You want to call the button. As I say, look in the handbook. You saw it, Dick. You looked at that guy, the way he made the loop and everything like that. And so, anybody's interested, take a look in the amateur radio handbook. I don't know if do you have any later editions after the 20th edition, Dick, over?
I think I have the 21st, but I think that section was not updated. No, go ahead.
Because I know it's in the 19th and the 20th edition. I don't think I have the 21st edition. Maybe I ought to get it to add it to my collection. I got them going way back. I would bring up one experiment that we did last week. That was Andy and I did an experiment. I made a statement last week to Andy on the TechNet. He was telling us that he got his beam up with 20-meter antenna and up there on the tower and all. And I said, gee, yeah. I said, you know, I never worked a guy out in your area on 20 meters. And he says, you're kidding. I said, no. He says, let's see if we can get together on 20 meters. So I aimed my beam out at Andy, all six elements of it, and up on an 85-foot tower. And Andy aimed his beam at me, and I just barely could pick him out. And he says, I could barely hear you. Well, finally, I put 1,500 watts straight at him, and I only could get, he says, up to about F4. Now, is that hard to believe that between here and what Hemp said, that we could not actually get copy on each other on 20 meters, Dick, over?
You are much too close for in the ionospheric. Ground wave is going to give you a reasonable amount of signal strength, but the band was probably open and the band was really hopping. If the band was closed, my guess is that would have been an easier path. What was the status of the band during that QSO? And did you do it right after the TechNet class?
Actually, no propagation at all. Zero. Band was dead. We were the only ones on the band. That's it. There is no propagation after the dock right now because we're still sitting on the bottom of the cycle 23. It's 18 months. Count last week, the solar count was 0, 0, straight zeros, an average of nothing. And this has been the way it's been now for quite a while. You get nothing on 20 meters at night. And this is the situation. With 1,500 watts going straight at you, you'd almost say from the top of my tower, I can almost maybe, almost with a good maybe scope, maybe almost see where he is. Because how far would you say, what is the temp? How far could that be from here in Brooklyn, right along the water over?
If you made a guess at the 20 miles between the two, is that in the right ballpark?
I'm 17 miles from JFK, and what would you say he is from JFK? Maybe another 10 miles? I don't know. How far is that? Well, you know that area. How far is where Andy is, would you say, from JFK over?
I don't know it, but you're 17 miles from JFK, and he might be another 10 miles, so maybe just 27 miles between the two of you. Wow. So 27 miles and a gallon on 20 meters. If your Yagi aimed at him, I don't know what kind of antenna he's using. What do you believe was the height of his antenna, Mel, go ahead.
Well, he's got the tower up. I don't know. What has he got? What did he put up? A 60-foot tower, I believe. You know, I think he's got three elements on 20 meters. I believe he put up a 20-meter beam on it. Too bad Andy's not on frequency right now. But I was amazed. I barely could hear him. I was listening. I mean, I had a lucky, there's no noise level to speak of on 20 meters. And I was barely listening, and I could just barely hear with the headphones on, with my sound canceling, Heil headphones on top of it, and using the Mark 5 receiver and everything. I mean, that's a really hot receiver. I tried everything, and he says, I can't hear you, Mel, really. We're using the this 2 meters, the repeater that we're using right now. So we were talking back and forth. I'm sitting with the handy talking in my lap in that radio shack and talking to him perfectly well with fire 2 meters. And I said, do you hear me now? Do you hear me now? Nope. Do you hear me now? Okay. I said, well, let me put the amplifier on. I'll blast it full power at you. And he says, oh, he says, yeah. He says, maybe you've got S4 over.
Did you do you like this?
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I was listening the same evening with Mel, and I had my beam on 20 meters pointed with 7 dB gain directly at Mel, and I could barely hear Andy in between from here in Atlantica. I couldn't really hear Mel at all. When he went up to 1500, I heard something very, very light, and I could kind of tell that Mel was in there, but almost non-copyable at all here. And what was really interesting is Mel and I had spoken a couple of times on 80 meters, and with just a few hundred watts, we hear each other absolutely perfect. It's amazing. Just doing the 20 meters, it's like there's a brick wall between us.
Now, you guys all know your antennas are working because when 20 meters are open, you get out like gangbusters. Wild. What was your S meter sitting at, Mel, during this QSO?
It was hardly moving. I don't think I really... There was almost no background noise or anything. It was just dead. Just like nothing ever existed, basically. And I could not hear Glenn. I couldn't hear him at all. Andy just barely in there. I could maybe tweak him up a little bit, but I was trying to get Glenn. I couldn't copy him at all on it. And he's barely hearing me. We tried everything. I mean, just to see if we could get through it. Like Glenn said, he joined us a number of times on 75 meters. Solid copy. So I would bet you also I'd get solid copy. I'm on 40 meters. So you can show that few megahertz what a difference it makes, Dick, over.
Yeah, because the number of wavelengths off the ground is not huge, you've got a fairly high angle of radiation. And what you guys are proving is that the ground wave on 20 meters, under those conditions at night, has a devil of a time getting beyond 20 miles. Wild. Who would have predicted? Whereas if you were aiming 2 meter antennas at each other, you guys would have been gangbusters.
Did you feel like you were one more pounded?
Go ahead, Glenn.
If you were probably on 10 meters, we probably wouldn't have a problem either. Because I know certainly into Brooklyn, Manhattan, New Jersey, on 10 meters too, it might take a little bit more power, but even still, 10 meters is quite copyable as well. So it's very interesting how somewhere, you know, just you know, in that midsection between like 40 meters and just, you know, below 10 meters. Some nights it's almost impossible to make short communications like that. They're really incredible.
Would you call that a skip zone situation? And how many miles out would you be able to, minimum, be able to QSO somebody?
Sometimes on 20 meters, it's very difficult to do things within 100 miles. After 100 miles, it becomes a real piece of cake. But sometimes within 100, it becomes really difficult there.
So from 10 miles to 100 miles is a skip zone. Is that approximately what you think, Mel?
You know, it's hard to say, Dick, because I, like I said, when I made that statement, I said, Andy, I doubt if I'll ever hear you on 20 meters. And he said, oh, you're kidding. How could that be? I said, let's try it, but take the handy coffee with me, because you're most likely going to have to tell you when I'm transmitting. And basically, that's exactly what happened. Now, if we go to, let's say, 30 meters. I work on 30 meters. I work people all over. 30 meters is 10 megahertz. So between 10 and 14 megahertz, you have this 4 megahertz difference, and the condition, the disparity is so enormous, it's hard to understand. I thought that it was my blockage, some kind of block, some kind of abnormality of my location to Long Island and all. But I hear that this is the norm. Now, no matter what, whether you're using a mobile antenna or a beam or whatever, it seems to be this is some kind of characteristic that you'll find at around 14 megahertz, Dick, over.
Amazing. The bewitching hour has come. That was segment number 1204. 73, you all. Back to you, Mel.
Dick, very good. This is K2KDY current. Let's try to do it again next week, and hope everybody enjoyed it. And Dick, you know, what we've discussed, I hope everything, you know, let me know if there's anything you'd like to discuss or, well, maybe I'll talk to you maybe during the week and see what's going on. 73 is all. Thank you very much, and take care. This is K2KDY.
Bye-bye, you all.
Thank you.